Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tim Geithner got half the day off today. The Treasury Secretary's afternoon testimony on Capitol Hill was postponed, which probably had him breathing a big sigh of relief, because in the morning session, Congress didn't really take too kindly to the administration's new financial rules. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, today the 18th of June. So glad you could be with us. The topic of the Secretary's half day on the Hill today was President Obama's proposal yesterday for new regulations for the financial industry. Members in the Senate Banking Committee pressed the Secretary on whether the Federal Reserve is the right choice to be the Uber regulator. There were complaints the proposal doesn't streamline the tangled web of financial regulators much, if at all. And those four little words we've come to know so well, too big to fail, oh, they were asking about those, too. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
If you didn't think we had enough confusing terms in our financial system, the Obama administration has come up with a new one, Tier 1 Financial Holding Company. Brace yourself for the description.
Any financial firm whose combination of size, leverage, and interconnectedness could pose a threat to financial stability if it failed.
To Chester Spatt, former chief economist of the SEC, that sounds a lot like a company that's too big to fail.
It provides a quasi-government guarantee and an unfair competitive advantage. And I think, therefore, heightens the ability of those institutions, in fact, to take on systemic risk.
On Capitol Hill today, Republican Senator David Vitter of Louisiana echoed that concern.
Tell me why that isn't a big, flashing neon sign, too big to fail.
Yeah. We are very worried about the
Secretary Geithner defended his plan, saying these Tier 1 firms wouldn't be allowed to take as much risk. And he said the plan would create a system to break up big institutions so that, in fact, they could be allowed to fail without taking the rest of us with them.
Our judgment is the combination of those two things will help mitigate the inherent moral hazard risk in any system that comes from the emergence of large institutions.
Of course, none of this will happen without lawmakers' approval. Congress could decide to limit the size of financial institutions. Chester Spatt suggests imposing fees that deter them from becoming so big. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The other big element of the president's plan is a new office specifically to protect consumers, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, CFPA it's called. To help us figure out how that office might work, we've got Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson on the Consumer Protection Desk in New York City today. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Kai.
On the theory that this thing is going to look at least something like the White House's proposal once Congress gets done with it, what is this agency going to regulate exactly?
Well, mortgages for a start, and these are the subprime adjustable rate mortgages, credit cards, car loans, payday loans. Any consumer financial product that is not already regulated by the SEC, which means not investments. They're not going to tell you which stocks to buy.
All right, then, Jeremy, let's say I go out to get a car loan or a mortgage. Is all the documentation with that loan going to have, you know, nutritional warning labels on the back, for instance, that are going to let me know default rates and all that kind of good stuff?
Well, they may, but really the work that has been done by this agency will have been done by the time you go down to get your car loan. So the loans available to you are going to be the simpler loans. Those will be up front. There may be loans that were more complicated and may trap you in some way that have been held away from the marketplace because they're deemed unsafe.
Saving me, I suppose, from myself then.
Right. Just the way the FDA saves you from yourself by not allowing certain products that are unsafe to get onto the shelves. Just the way that the Consumer Product Safety Commission won't allow you to buy a boogie board that's covered in lead paint. This is going to keep you from financial products that may be harmful to you, that may leave you out on the street or in bankruptcy court.
But I'm a grown-up. Don't I get to make my own decisions?
Well, that's right. This is going to affect people that are savvy consumers who might want to be able to make their own decisions. But I guess the government has decided that it's better to err on the safe side rather than allowing people the kind of choice that they have right now.
What if something bad does happen with one of these newly regulated products and I find myself in a mortgage that's bad for me or a car loan or a student loan that's bad? Do I have any recourse?
Well, you do if the lender did something fraudulent, like let's say that they used a phony pay stub for you to try to get you into a mortgage that you couldn't afford. But if they did everything they were supposed to do, then you're holding the bag.
You know, Jeremy, yesterday the president made a big point about getting rid of all the fine print that none of us can or have the time to read. Is that really going to happen?
Well, one administration official I spoke to today said there will still be fine print, but it'll be the kind of thing like on the internet when you click the box that says I agree to the terms and conditions and you click OK. It will actually be OK. You won't have to worry that something in the fine print will trap you down the road.
Jeremy Hobson in New York for us. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you, Kai.
We've been talking so far today about the structural changes the White House wants to make to the financial industry. Commentator Thomas Frank says it's time to start paying attention to the political part of the problem, too.
Everyone agrees that the financial sector needs a regulatory overhaul in the aftermath of the recent disaster. But the reason our banking regulators napped through the housing crisis is not merely because of confusing jurisdictions. It's also because of the kind of people who were chosen for the job. They were asleep at the switch because industry wanted them to be asleep. Now, the reason for that is simple. There are enormously powerful institutions in America that don't want to be regulated. Regulation cuts into their profits, and they've used the political process to sabotage, capture, defund, or undo the regulatory state since the very beginning. The first regulatory agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, was set up to regulate railroad freight rates way back in 1887. Immediately thereafter, a prominent railroad lawyer came to Washington as attorney general. His former boss asked him if he would kill off the hated commission. His response, I think, should be on display in the National Archives next to our country's other great founding documents. This is what he said. The commission is, or can be made, of great use to the railroads. It satisfies the popular clamor for government supervision of the railroads, while at the same time that supervision is almost entirely nominal. The part of wisdom is not to destroy the commission, but to utilize it. And so it has been, on and off, ever since. An FDA run in the interests of Big Pharma, a Labor Department that apparently thinks its mission is to police workers' organizations, and of course, banking regulators who posed for pictures with banking lobbyists holding a chainsaw to a pile of regulations. Let WaMu do whatever they want. Smiles all around. Look, the problem with bad regulators is a political one, not merely a structural one, and President Obama can't solve it by ignoring it. To counter industry's endless effort to undermine regulation, we must have an informed and maybe even an angry public. Obama needs to tell us what happened and why, and prepare us to remain vigilant even after the crisis has passed.
Thomas Frank is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. On Wall Street, today the place, not the paper, the major indices were mixed once again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are more economic statistics out there than anybody can really keep a track of. There are the A-list figures like gross domestic product and the monthly unemployment report. And then in descending order, you've got things like the leading economic indicators, which we learned today were positive for the second month in a row. Also, the weekly unemployment report. the number of people making their first claims for jobless benefits. That is a notoriously volatile number. It changes a lot from week to week. But given how important unemployment is in this recession, it's getting a lot of attention. The Labor Department shared with us this morning that the number of people on the unemployment rolls has fallen for the first time since early January. It is a promising sign, to be sure. But also, as Tamara Keith reports now from Washington, more less bad than actually good.
In the week ending June 6th, there were 148,000 fewer people on the unemployment insurance rolls than the week before. Greg McBride at Bankrate.com says the number of new people seeking unemployment also dropped a bit.
There are still a lot of people coming through the door looking to file for unemployment insurance, but there are fewer people coming in the door than was the case just a couple of months ago.
Still, a staggering 6.7 million people are getting unemployment checks. Economists who spend lots of time looking at data see signs of life. But what are the rest of us to think? So I parked myself in front of a D.C. metro station and accosted strangers with the latest numbers.
Total unemployment insurance rolls fell by 148,000. So does that seem like good news to you?
College student Daniel Otzman took off his aviator sunglasses to get a closer look at the data.
I mean, when you still have a number like 6.7 million unemployed, and you see that the total unemployment rate is still rising, it doesn't really do it for me.
Accountant Marcus Oliver didn't see good news either.
Unfortunately, I don't really buy into the numbers that you get from the government. I think there's always something a little bit under the rug.
He's right, sort of. Andrew Stettner with the National Employment Law Project says people who've been unemployed more than 6 months and are now getting extended benefits are counted differently.
The total number of people on unemployment benefits has not dropped. It is just people are moving, you know, from the state benefits to the extension.
And maybe this proves you can't read too much into any one number. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Coming up, on-the-job training for a 13-year-old.
When I don't hold a blowtorch steady, the flame goes all over.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was, as I said, in a mixed mood today. The Dow Industrials ended a three-day losing streak, bouncing 58 points higher, 0.2%, closed at 8,555. The Nasdaq slipped just a sliver of a point at an even smaller fraction of a percent, ended the day essentially flat, 1807. That was a long way to say that, I know. The S&P 500 clawed back 7 points, 0.8%, wrapped up at 918. Bank stocks jumped today. Bank of America rang up nearly 5%. J.P. Morgan Chase charged up almost 4.5%. Wells Fargo added more than 2.5%. Discover Financial Services got a lift from $1.2 billion in federal rescue funds. Its shares gained 4% on strong second quarter profits. Bond prices fell, which means yields were on the rise again, up 3.8% for 10-year T-notes. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Banquet, Hebrew National, and Peter Pan. More at conagrafoods.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The House Budget Committee holds a hearing on the economic case for health reform. The 65th Annual Radio and Television Correspondents Association Dinner takes place at the Washington Convention Center. And an actress with a smoky voice and a long list of credits, including Body Heat, celebrates her birthday. Kathleen Turner turns 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back in March, we had a guy named Dustin Woodman on the program. Dustin is the program manager for the Coconino Rural Environment Corps. That's an AmeriCorps program in northern Arizona that helps young people in forestry and water conservation and other things like that. We had called him because we wanted to see what the economic stimulus package looked like from the ground up, from the people who were in line to get some of that money. When we talked, Dustin was in that line, waiting for stimulus funds to trickle down to him. Some of it finally has, so we got him back on the phone. Dustin, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Kai.
Last time we spoke, you were hoping to be able to put some young people to work out there with some of this stimulus money. Has that actually happened?
It's actually under works right now. We've begun to see the first of the recovery funding that we were anticipating, and we're looking to put some boots on the ground beginning the first week of July.
How much money did you get?
We got approximately $500,000 in AmeriCorps recovery grants.
$500,000, that's a lot of money.
It is, and it's going to go a long ways to create some temporary job training opportunities for local youth and young adults.
Are you getting applications for those jobs?
Absolutely, more than we can handle. We're looking to probably field close to 55, 56 positions with this funding, and right now we're receiving 4 to 5 applications for every position that we think we're able to field.
Do they have other options out there to work?
To be honest, not many. There have been many service cuts here in our local area, reducing the number of summer opportunities for young people. Definitely unemployment has gone up within our county and within our region. So I think that speaks to the great increase in applicants that we're receiving for these very limited number of positions.
When we talked, you were hoping to get this all done by late April, early May. Needless to say, it's a bit later than that now, isn't it?
We've been in a holding pattern for several months, really, all in hopes and anticipation of the recovery funding enabling us to ramp up again.
Is this money enough for you to get done what you want to get done there in Coconino County?
Not entirely. All of these funds requires some significant matching amounts, and so we're looking to our community partners. Our ability really to bring on these additional young people and field these boots on the ground is contingent on our ability to partner with outside agencies to accomplish their goals as well. So we definitely are working on building, retaining, and strengthening those relationships.
Give me a little tour through the bureaucracy of all this. Did you have to fill out an application, apply, call your congressman? How'd you get the money?
All current AmeriCorps grantees, regardless of how the funding streams down to the programs, were eligible for recovery funding. And I think that was a system put into place to ensure expedient expenditure of the funding. Other funding sources we're still looking out for and anticipate having to submit additional applications for.
Sounds relatively painless.
Well, I wouldn't say that. It certainly is a good deal of work.
So give the stimulus bill, from your perspective on the ground there, give it a grade. Is it a gentleman's C, or maybe a little bit better or worse?
You know, at this point, I'd go ahead and keep it in the B plus category. I think the delays have probably been due to a lot of work at the federal level, reconciling the need for expediency and the need to get that funding out with the most transparent measures in place.
Are you confident that you're going to be able to see some kind of economic development benefit out there from this money?
I think so. I think not only in terms of the training provided and the post-core placements for members, but also in the accomplishments on the ground from the work being performed by our members, stimulating the economy by providing more fulfilling and enriching recreational experiences for visitors to our area, which is a very large part of the local economy.
Dustin Woodman, he's the project manager for the Coconino Rural Environment Corps out there in Coconino County, Arizona. Dustin, thanks a lot.
Great to talk to you again, Kai.
Today, our series Working, about the lives of individuals in the global economy, takes us to Bangladesh, the city of Chittagong on the coast, where old oil tankers and cargo ships go to die. For the equivalent of $2 a day, small armies of workers using little more than hammers and blowtorches take the ships apart plate by metal plate, somehow finding the energy to sing work songs as they do it. A lot of those ships arrive full of toxic waste. You add on the sheer danger of breaking down an old ship, basically by hand, and it's hardly a place you'd expect to find children, much less child laborers.
But they're everywhere. Estimates are that one of every four workers in the shipyards of Chittagong is a child. Today, from Sandy Tolan, the diary of 13-year-old Babu Hussein.
It's really frustrating the way I begin my days. I don't know whether I should go to work or not. I feel sick and tired, but my parents don't like me being absent from my work. My supervisors don't like it either. They use abusive language, so I go back to work as usual. During my journey to work, I think about what I need to do first. If I'm late to work, my masters call my parents' names. They use F-words about my mother. They don't hesitate to slap my face for being 5 minutes tardy. I'm amazed when I walk through the ship. How big it is. Who had the brains to build it? It's just beyond my imagination how it was built. First, I have to go get the blowtorch and the oxygen cylinder and bring them back to my master. When my master cuts a piece of steel, it's too hot to touch. Still, we grab the steel sheets and throw them off the ship barehanded. The heat of the flame is unbearable. The hot fire sometimes burns our legs. If we try to move away from the flames, the bosses become very angry and yell at us like, "Hey, son of a bitch, come back over here." We work all day long standing in the sun. It's so hot. We don't get a hat, an umbrella, or anything to protect our bodies. They don't even provide water for us. Sometimes when our masters get tired, they ask us to do their job. They take a nap and make us kids operate the blowtorch. The torch makes a hissing sound. It's really dangerous. I have to hold the torch still until the steel gets hot and melted. When I don't hold the blowtorch steady, the flame goes all over. If the cutting isn't straight, it makes metal splinters, which can fly up into my face. Thank God they've never hit my eyeballs. They usually don't provide us with protective equipment, but when any law enforcement agency comes into the yard to check, they immediately provide all this stuff for half an hour or so. Then they take it back when the inspectors leave. My question is why? Why do they only provide this stuff when the law enforcement people come? Why don't they give it to us all day, every day, so we can protect ourselves? I have to be very careful when I work. I have to stay alert all the time. I know my parents worry about me. I have to keep an eye out in case something falls on me.
I'm very worried about my Babu because he's the oldest and the firstborn in the family. An accident can happen at any time. I've heard of lots of people who have lost their legs and hands and whatnot. And if anything happens to Babu, they won't even pay any compensation. This is my constant pain and tension.
The height of these ships is so alarming. It's really scary to climb. Once on a windy day, a worker died when he fell off. One day, my boss sent me up high in the ship to find some work boots. I climbed the ladder as high as a 10-story building. The ladder was made of bamboo and rope. I was so scared. It was so high. I'm overjoyed when I'm finally done with my work and can go home. During the first half hour, I rest a while. Then I take a bath. feel very good when I take my bath. My body gets cooler. Then I have my dinner and I walk around with my friends before I go to sleep. I have bad dreams about my work. Sometimes I dream about big pieces of steel dropping on me. Sometimes I dream that my boss has thrown me into melted iron.
My name is Atikur Rahman Belaid, 37 years old. I am Babu's father. I came to Chittagong at the age of 13. I had to leave home because of financial hardship. I needed a job. Of course, I felt bad when we discussed the issue of sending Babu to work. It was a difficult decision for me, because at his age, he was supposed to go to school and play. But at a certain point, we realized that Babu wasn't paying attention to his education and not showing interest in continuing his studies. He started hanging around with the bad guys in the neighborhood. So my wife and I discussed it and decided together to send him to work.
My work is crucial for my family. My dad doesn't have a regular job. Sometimes he has work, sometimes he doesn't. When he doesn't, I'm the only financial support for the family. If I don't work, my family will starve. I love to play with my brothers, sisters, and neighbors. I stand by the playground and watch them playing. I have so much fun with them. Cricket, football, hide and seek. I don't go very far and I always hide nearby so they can find me. There is no fun in the work. The way we comfort ourselves is to think that they are our masters. As long as they're in command, we have nothing to say. We're bound to be at their service. I wish I could find something easier to do. I have a friend who works as a taxi driver. He promises to teach me how to drive when I grow up. It would be good if I could go to school. But I have no choice. So I go back to work.
Sandy Tolan produced that story for us with help from Mainul Islam Khan. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. To see some pictures of Babu Hussein and what it looks like when a ship gets broken apart, you can go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, a nod to a scandal gone by. A state judge in Alabama has ordered former HealthSouth CEO Richard Scrugie to pay shareholders almost $3 billion. The case is the result of an accounting fraud that all but sank the hospital chain 5 years ago. Scrugie was acquitted in a federal criminal trial, but he's doing 7 years in state prison for an unrelated bribery conviction. A statement from the company today said it's not clear how much of that $3 billion can actually be collected. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 58 points, two-thirds of 1%. The Nasdaq basically flat. The S&P 500 inched up 7 points, eight-tenths percent. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, a museum in Athens opens, missing some pieces.
Everybody from the world will, on leaving the museum, say, where are the rest of them? And they'll say, well, they're in the British Museum.
A little Greek history on the program tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.